could hear this
sound. With 21 correspondents in 7 countries from around the world, this is Bondi Tunes International.
Hello there! You're listening to Bondi Tunes International with a mix of contributions from our correspondents all over the world. From the serious to the sublime, from the funny to the fantastic, 13 years on air. But this is just a selection from the past 2 years. Bondi Tunes International, it's real radio.
Around the world and down your street.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney. How you doing? I'm joined by our Australian political correspondent, Adam Devlin, and Rachel Brunson, who is our entertainment reporter. They're both in Melbourne. They're, as we record the state of Victoria, where Rachel and Adam are, had a peak in viruses, 16 cases of coronavirus. Guys, who wants to scream first? The world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, where there's current flooding going on around the whole eastern seaboard of Australia, and we're copping it big time here. Not so in Texas, where I'm joined by our correspondent there, Thomas Booker, in San Antonio de Bayo. And you had a barbecue, you say. Did you have any beers?
Did you have any beers? Yes, that does. Yeah, I understand that, Henry. Yeah, hang on a second. You have, with the floods you've been going through. There, how's that?
Oh, fantastic.
Adam, tell me your take on this, please.
Yes, well, the latest advice that I've seen this afternoon is that the 4 people who were at those protests that have now got it did not get it at the protests. And this is the issue with this virus, is that we're still trying to figure out how it works.
In Sydney, Australia, I'm joined by 2 of our correspondents who've been with us for 12 years since this broadcast started. Suckers for punishment. Punishment, I say. Adam Devlin is in Melbourne and Rachel Brunston is in Canberra. Welcome to our broadcast.
Thanks hello, ever hello. So much. It's so nice to be with the 2 of you. We haven't been together for such a long time.
That's right. And to celebrate that, we're going to talk about nothing.
I love talking about nothing. It's my favourite thing.
It's the one thing I know something about.
Exactly. Everyone's an expert.
Yeah, I was actually... It's funny that I'm talking to you about this sort of thing now, because I was actually YouTubing, really pushing it on YouTube with regard to space and the possibility of life forms on planets similar to planet Earth. And one of these videos that I watched suggested that really there's a high chance that we are alone in the universe, because it was such a spectacular thing, the black hole. All of this stuff was just so unlikely. What are your thoughts on that?
We don't know enough. Once again, we've had 3,000 years worth of intellectual inquiry into the nature of physics and astronomy and biology. I mean, it would be 3,000 years worth of various scientific inquiry. Okay, so from my standpoint, life is basically chemistry. It's DNA, amino acids. It's the Stanley-Urey experiment. I don't know if you're. This is another classic, famous experiment that took place in the early 50s, I believe. Maybe it was the early 60s, where he had a spark gap that he put over a flask, and in the flask it was basic elements and hydrogen and a few hydrogen and pneumonia and a few other things, but. He zapped it and had it zapping continuously for months. And toward the end of it, he wound up having a vat of discolored liquid that was teeming with amino acids, which he was saying. So he was saying, creating the model of the early Earth where there was water abounding and lightning. There were lots of lightning and lots of discharges. And over the course of the few billion years, the Earth was able to create amino acids, which initiated the combinations which wound up being creating life. And that was one mode. I don't know how highly regarded that particular experiment is, but there are other modes. They're talking about Europa, the moon of Jupiter, being a water moon, also harboring, because of the processes, because of the gravitational processes, the fact that water is liquid under the ice on Europa. They're almost positive about that. And as a result of the water is liquid, there could possibly be life initiating chemistry in that environment.
But of course, Thomas, it just blows me away to try and think about. Let's talk about the word infinity. yeah. You know the way you look at, you know, space, millions and millions of stars, planets, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. When see, this is an impossible question to answer. When does it stop? Does infinity exist? Like, how can it just go on forever?
The universe is not necessarily infinite. It is, you know, it basically.
But what happens after that? You don't come to a wall.
This is when you're going to have to start taking. Maybe
I might have to start taking drugs.
Yeah, do the Aborigines have any kind of hallucinogenic drugs that you can contact the advanced spirit world? There are, you know.
I'll keep that in mind.
This is Ling Pang for Bond 9 Tunes International, and I talked with Kika D, courtesy of Livewire. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Ling. I'm very well. Thank you for talking to me.
With pleasure. I'm a huge fan of your music, and particularly the incredible, iconic duet, Don't Go Breaking My Heart, with Elton John.
Absolutely, 1976.
40-odd years ago now, isn't it?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, it's a little bit more, I think. I've worked it out, but the thing is that I'd done quite a lot before that. You know, I've had a couple of hit records in the UK, so it was good in a way when that duet came out, you know, to have had a career already, because I was then ready to, you know, to deal with the madness that took place because it did so well around the world.
I understand your musical interest started very young, literally from home, from the music that you hear on records. Was it from your brother or your sister? And then you won some competitions in singing, I believe.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the youngest of three children from Yorkshire, Bradford, Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And my big brother was a bit of a rock and roll fan. We're talking mid-50s now. I was a little girl. Mm-hmm. And my sister played the piano a little bit. Mm. And I found, to get attention, being the youngest of three, that if I sung around the house and, you know, when someone came to visit, I'd say, "Mum, can I sing? Can I sing?" you know, children are like. And that's really how it started. And I used to enter talent.
You've got a beautiful tone, powerful voice, as you can hear in your singles like Star and I've Got Music in Me. You know it's Kika D singing when you hear it, because you've got such a unique voice, and that belongs only to you.
Well, that's nice of you. Thank you. Because I think all the, you know, from my time, all the big stars, you know, the people who've been around and managed to keep their careers going, have all got a unique sound, haven't they?
Yes, they have, yeah.
So you need that something that makes you. And I guess I've got my own sound now, which is, you know, which is great. And I think it's, you know, without sounding precocious or anything, I think whatever I've got is God-given, because I don't read music, and I just found that I could sing in tune and harmonise when I was a little girl.
So you hear music by ear.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing technical about me. It's just instinct. And play a little bit of keyboards now with my live acoustic show that I do with a wonderful guitarist called Carmelo Ruggeri. He's Italian. I mean, I do play a bit of keys, but just for colour for his guitar. And,
yeah. During your long musical career, you have released 40 singles, 3 EPs, and a dozen albums. That is such amazing achievements. When you did your duet with Elton John, was that the kickstart of your fame globally?
I guess on that level it was. Like I said, I had a record deal for 10 years before I signed with Elton's label. And I also did an album for Tamla Motown in 1969. So I had some recognition, and then I had a couple of, like I said, a couple of hit records with a song called Amoureuse in 73.
Oh, I love that song.
And then I've Got Music in Me, and then Don't Go Breaking My Heart. So yeah. I'm glad that it wasn't just Don't Go Breaking My Heart, because it's so iconic, but I had my identity.
If you've just joined us, this is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world and also from Sydney, Australia, where I am. And I'm talking with Dawn Drost, our North America political correspondent in Orlando, Florida. She is in Orlando, Florida, so that means it's time for Silly Floridian of the Week. Dawn, what's going on over there at the moment?
Well, this week we have a delightful man named Gumercindo Reyes Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He is 51 years old. This actually took place here in the Orlando area, so it's a local crime. He decided it would be fun to dress up as a woman and rob a bank.
Okay. I'm looking at a picture with this lovely gold dress.
Yes, he did not make a lovely woman, but he went into the bank anyway. It was a Chase Bank. Mm. He walked in with a sign, with a note that was written in Spanish.
Oh.
That said, it was a multilingual crime. And it said, I have sufficient weapons to kill everybody here.
Did he have them?
Nobody knows. Give me your car keys. I want unmarked bills and nothing electronic, because if so, I'll start to shoot. But he did have a purse, so no one really knows what was in his purse.
Little handgun. Little lady handgun.
Yes, it's possible.
Why do they hand the money over so easily? I thought they had all sorts of ways of avoiding this these days.
Well, they didn't give him much. They only gave him $1,000.
Mm.
And they could have, you know, the bank has a vault. You know, they could have given him a lot more. So they probably just emptied one drawer and gave him that. So as he was leaving, the deputy driving by noticed that Reyes was coming out of a restaurant called Pollo Tropical, where he had ditched his clothes and changed into men's clothes, and he was walking out of a bush. That is the first way you attract police attention. Use the sidewalk. Don't cut through the shrubbery.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came out of the bushes. He confronted the man. When he exited the car, he saw bizarre behavior. He attempted to subdue him by tasing him.
Uh-huh.
This is Florida.
Yes.
And that didn't work. So they ended up having a foot chase, and they ran across an extremely busy road, like 8 lanes of traffic.
Shit.
This is one of the busiest roads. Actually, this is the busiest road in that county. 8 lanes of traffic.
Mm.
And into an apartment complex. There, the deputy reached for his gun and ordered Reyes to the ground. Reyes reached for the gun. Again, Florida. The deputy was able to regain control of the gun. I'm amazed that it did not deploy at some point and that nobody got shot. And the altercation continued. The deputy tased him again.
Was he not taseable?
I want to know. This man must have been on drugs. Because seriously, you get tased twice and you don't go down. You are on something.
Yeah, probably.
The tasing I have seen in person, that man was high as a kite, and they had to tase him 3 or 4 times.
My God.
But again, he was naked outside of a school. They tased him a lot, and he was just flopping like a fish on the sidewalk.
Was that another event, Dawn? Was that another thing that he did? He said naked outside of school?
Oh, that was one I saw in person. That was my introduction to Florida.
Oh, I see.
That was just driving to work one day. I was late to work. I just stopped and just sat in traffic watching that. I was just like, I do not know what's happening, but I am going to sit here and find out.
Did you ever want to turn your car around and go back?
Oh, I just stopped and watched.
Amusement. This is Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting from Sydney, Australia. Of course, around the world. And around the world, I go to our North America political correspondent, Ronan Seagrave, who is in Canada, in Winnipeg. Welcome to our broadcast.
Good evening, Henry.
It's quite a week that was, as our jingle says, with Enda at the beginning of this show. Gay Byrne basically was RTE. He was RTE, the national broadcaster in Ireland. He was a broadcaster for some six decades on Irish radio, then Irish television, and he actually went to Granada TV in the UK at one stage. But let's talk about Gay's involvement with Irish politics. The social life of Ireland at the time. This show started on the 5th of July 1962. It was called The Late Late Show. 3 days after I was born, Ronan, I think I just got into the world 3 days in time to watch Gaybo. Tell us about Gay Byrne and his effect on the Irish scene, because let's face it, the Catholic Church ran Catholic Ireland at the time.
It did. I mean, Gay Byrne had, he was without question, Henry, one of the most significant people in Ireland over the past, as you say, 50, 60 years. I mean, we both grew up with Gay Byrne. He was everywhere. He had his daily radio show on RT Radio 1. He was probably the first person on Irish radio, Henry, to have the phone in, people actually ringing him up and talking about issues of the day. I mean, he was doing that in late 60s, early 70s. Mm. And then, of course, The Late Late Show, as you say, which started in 1962 and which he presented continuously for 37 years.
Yeah, but it's important to note that Gay Byrne, let's just go back a bit. In the late 50s, he had been working on the national broadcaster, RTE Radio 1, which was the only broadcaster in Ireland. He went for a fleeting visit to the UK and Granada TV, and that was 1963. But in 1962, he is given 12 shows, apparently, of The Late Late Show on RTE. And look at all these years later.
Yeah, quite extraordinary. No one could have thought back then that Gay Byrne would have been presenting that show, as I say, for 37 years. I mean, he did, as you say, spend a bit of time sort of going back and forth to England. I mean, famously on Granada TV, he interviewed the Beatles.
Yes.
In a memorable clip. He didn't really like England, Henry. I mean, he didn't like London at all, and he made a decision sort of in the early 60s to really just focus his career in Ireland and living in Dublin. Mm. And he became really the face and voice of RTE, was as I say, with the daily radio show and The Late Late Show, which he also produced. I mean, he was a man, Henry, with an enormous appetite for work.
Yeah, and he did. He did produce. We've got a bit of a bad line here, Ronan, but he did produce it. And just to explain, producing means timing the ad breaks. And I think RTE had ad breaks at the time, still do. And if you're a producer, you've got to time everything. And he's doing that and multitasking. And I just want to briefly mention something very funny, because Gay Byrne never used an auto cue. Never. He hated them. And in the 90s, and sorry, I think we need to go further into the early 2000s, when a man called Ryan Tubridy, I never pronounce his name properly, who continues to do The Late Late Show, one of the longest running entertainment TV shows on the planet. Anyway, he's sitting there being interviewed by Ryan, and he goes up to the camera and covers the auto cue and says, "Now try and see, how you present this show." It is interesting, Ronan, that there was really very little organization to this show. Use the term freewheeling. It really was, wasn't it?
It was freewheeling. I mean, the show was a mix of, often celebrity interviews, big name movie stars, people like Charlton Heston appeared on the show. Gay was terrific, Henry, with guests I would describe as sort of raconteurs, Peter Ustinov, Spike Milligan, Billy Connolly. They were kind of frequent guests on the show, and Gay would just let them tell sort of very, very funny stories. But then it also had sort of what I would describe as sort of groundbreaking sort of social debates,
yes,
which after really the first time, Henry, on Irish television, such subjects were debated. I mean, he had a show in, I think, the late 70s or early 80s on sort of gay rights, which was not heard of at all on RTE. Various vigorous debates on subjects like birth control. There's a famous clip of Gay demonstrating how to use a condom, for which he got a lot of criticism at the time, when I think such devices were banned in Ireland.
Yes, they were.
Divorce, and, abortion.
And Ronan, we'll just play a clip, and just to explain to our audience, this is radio, not television, but he's showing up a condom not only to the audience in studio, but to the entire population of Ireland, because you've got to remember there was only one channel on a Saturday night as it was broadcast then. Everyone watched The Late Late Show, and a lot of nasty letters came into the RTE studios after he did this, showing the condom. Let's take an audio grab of that now.
OK, if you'll pardon the expression, Roisin, would you roll it there, please? The condom is made of rubber, whether you knew it or not. There are two main types.
I would not encourage my children to use condoms.
How old are your children?
One's 27, one's down at the telly ball, if you have to leave.
Never before has your show stooped so low to discuss so little. Oh boy, what a show it turned out to be. Not a holy show, but a dirty, disgraceful, rude, garbage heap of codswallop.
Of course, we recognise that people have misgivings about homosexuality because it's something that they don't come across every day.
But how can you say it's normal?
Ken? Yeah, that is
because it's perfectly normal for me.
It's not normal for a man to be preoccupied with another man's back passage.
What about men who are besotted with women's front passages? Is the flip answer to that?
Okay.
Good evening.
Hello. You're asking what would we do if our husbands had an affair?
Aye.
A lot of us would be only delighted to get a rest.
Hello there! You're listening to Bondi Tunes International with a mix of contributions from our correspondents all over the world. From the serious to the sublime, from the funny to the fantastic. 13 years on air, but this is just a selection from the past 2 years. Bondi Tunes International, it's real radio. And around the globe I go to our Irish correspondent, Bob McKenzie in Dublin. Hey Bob, how you doing?
I'm good, Henry. How are you?
I'm alive and kicking. Hey, what did you do for Paddy's Day last week?
What did I do for Paddy's Day? Oh,
yes, well, you're in the right country.
We had a parade in Bray, and a gentleman who you would be aware of was actually the Grand Marshal for the Bray Parade, a certain Mr. Declan Meehan.
Is that right? Of course, he works in Bray.
Declan has finally achieved legendary status that he gets these sort of gigs after 25 years of doing a talk show on the local radio station out here in Wicklow on East Coast FM or East Coast Radio, whatever they call it this week. So he was asked to be the marshal for the parade. So well done, Deck.
Yes. It
wasn't much like Decky's Brekkie Trekkie, but, you know.
What can you do?
Exactly. But of course, whenever I think of Declan, I think of Bob Gallico, of course, our old friend from back in the day, who I worked alongside for many, many years, as you know, and who is sadly missed. And, of course, his father was Paul Gallico, who wrote The Poseidon Adventure. So, you know, it all fits in.
Yes, it's like 3 degrees of separation there. And, of course, his father, Paul Gallico, also loved cats and wrote lots of books.
He did indeed. And, of course, he was very good friends with Damon Runyon, who wrote Guys and Dolls. And the two of them started out as sports journalists and ended up in Hollywood. And Damon and Paul Gallico were also the founders of the Golden Gloves Amateur Boxing Tournament in New York.
Gosh, you've done your research. I did not know.
Well, I always found the two of them fascinating. Damon particularly, because I'm a big fan of Damon Runyon, because of his writing style. It's so different to virtually anybody else around, to be fair.
And have you read a lot of Paul's stuff?
Oh, God, yeah. You know me. I'm a bibliophile, if ever there was one.
You're an avid reader. I know that.
Well, last week, there were two new books out by a guy called Peter Swanson and another guy called Harlan Coben. And I bought them on one day and I had them finished the next.
Oh, my God.
So that's That's what I'm like. When I get tucked in, I'm currently reading a fabulous Irish author called Andrea Mara, who's got about four books out. But I read a book of hers last week called All Her Faults, about the kidnapping of a child. It's one of the best books I've read in quite some time. I'm sure you can probably get Andrea Mara's books in Australia, because you know yourself, the Irish authors do tend to try and get a foothold in the Australian market because they know they will sell. She's pretty good, I have to say.
You know what? Let's talk about your Facebook page, because we didn't talk about that last time. We talked about it the time before. Tell us about that. Just tell our listeners about that again.
Well, I run a page on Facebook called Book Punk. And basically, it's just a page where readers can, you know, join the page. And basically, we recommend books to each other. We discuss books. We also, at Christmas, I always do, I've done two Christmases now. We're about 18 months going. And we raise money for charity. We raised a couple of grand this year just for, you know, local charities. This year it's for Purple House, who are a cancer charity based in Bray. So that's what we do. We try to do good things with it. I keep saying I'm going to do a podcast, but I haven't actually got round to that yet.
You know,
procrastination is the thief of time, Henry. and I have a lot of time being thieved.
It's interesting, and I'm really glad that we have you on this radio show. For so many reasons, Melissa Greimer.
Thank you.
I am so impressed with you because, you know, you're in your early 40s. A lot of people of your age group really don't care enough. And it's as simple as that. They don't. And people of my age group, I'm 59, people over 60 don't understand what's going on. They listen to the likes of Alan Jones on AM radio. He's a shock jock, a right-wing one at that. And he just got kicked off Sky News. Ha ha, that was funny. But I'm so impressed with you because, as I say, you know, a lot of people your age maybe are married or have children or whatever. They just don't seem to care. And they watch Channel 9 News and these commercial networks. And I look at the news only because I want to see local news in Sydney. And I just look at it and think, I don't believe any of this stuff. You are a thinking person, and this is becoming a very rare commodity. I just want to ask you why you're so passionate. Because I know it sounds like a simple question, but why are you so passionate? Are you scared? Are you scared of your lifestyle being changed?
I'm scared of what these laws can do. I was arrested once in Sydney.
You were?
Because I witnessed police officers beating someone, and they thought that I had video footage of the assault taking place when all I had done was try to take a photo of the officer's name badge and, his name pretty much. And so I was arrested. I had my phone taken off me. They went through my phone for 4 hours while I was in a holding cell.
Really?
We have footage of them going through my phone.
How do you have footage of that?
Because I had to get a lawyer, and the lawyer subpoenaed the video footage of me while I was in lockup, and you could see them going through my phone. And to distract me, I was led away by two female police officers and strip searched. They had no right to strip search me. I had not presented like I was on drugs or that I was going to self-harm. So they didn't actually have any right to strip search me. And I flatly refused, and they forced one upon me. I told them that being strip searched to me was akin to being sexually assaulted, and I wanted a counsellor there to be able to talk to while this was happening. They refused.
My goodness.
And then when I was in court and the judge heard what happened, the judge said to my lawyer, "I believe that your client has a case for indecent assault against the police because they weren't within their rights to strip search her."
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. Now, there's a national election going on in the Republic of Ireland, and I'm joined by our North America political correspondent, Ronan Seagrave, in Winnipeg. He happens to be Irish. Welcome to our show, Ronan.
Good evening, Henry.
This is different. Just to paint a picture for our listeners around the world, the Republic of Ireland has had two major parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who have dominated elections for God knows how many decades. And now we've got Sinn Féin, who used to be the political wing of the IRA, a very violent organisation from the 1970s. They're kicking ass, Ronan.
It is quite an extraordinary election, Henry. You're quite right. I mean, politics in Ireland for the past 100 years really has been dominated by, you know, Fianna Fáil, you know, a sort of quasi sort of nationalist Republican Party, but very centrist, either flipping centre right or centre left, and quite populist in some of its past history in terms of offering goodies to the voters. But of course, it's still in recovery from the financial crisis that started in 2008, where we had the banks being nationalised and essentially, Henry, the country being sort of bankrupted with an ERM rescue and, you know, the bailout. And it's sort of been in recovery mode since then. That went into this election, I think, feeling it would do much better than it did.
Mm. Leo Varadkar, I never pronounce his name correctly, is the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach.
Leo Varadkar, yeah.
And he is from Fine Gael, as far as I understand. And I believe there's currently a coalition between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Is that right?
No. Fine Gael have been in power, Henry, in one shape or another for the past 9 years, really, since the bailout, the IMF bailout, and the financial collapse and the financial crisis in Ireland. They reaped the benefit of that, along with initially the Labour Party, who won a general in 15, Henry, with sort of austerity really biting. The Labour Party vote effectively collapsed. Fine Gael lost seats, but actually stayed in power through a combination of sort of some support from independents and Fianna Fáil actually agreeing a supply arrangement whereby they would agree to abstain on certain kind of key votes like passing budgets and things like that.
I mean, it seems ridiculous. I just heard at one point that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were in some kind of coalition, which seemed astounding to me because they're arch rivals, really, aren't they?
Well, funnily enough, Henry, it might be back on the table now. So what we've had in this election, Henry, has been a surge in the vote for Sinn Féin. And for listeners' benefit, I mean, Sinn Féin was for many years the political wing of the Provisional IRA, and would still have a number of people in that party, including some people who are running in this election, Henry, who were sort of former members or certainly associated with the IRA. And I've basically had a political appeal, Henry, that's based on sort of staunch militant republicanism. They want a united Ireland. Now, of course, they're in the sort of peace process with not advocating violence, but obviously having that quite recent past in terms of the association with the Provisional IRA, and including, Henry, all sorts of assertions by some people that they're still taking direction from the IRA Army Council. Mm-hmm. That was combined, Henry, with, I would describe, a sort of fairly hard left economic policies. I mean, there was €12 billion of spending commitments, particularly in areas like housing and the health service, you know, raising taxes on what they would describe as the rich, but that's really anybody above earning €80,000 a year in Ireland. And they had a very populist appeal, Henry, and their appeal was sort of based on that sort of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been dominating politics in Ireland for nearly a century. They're captured by elites. You know, they're only interested in wealthy financial interests. They've sort of ignored or failed to respond to quite serious sort of social problems, particularly homelessness, a dysfunctional housing market with rising property prices and rent values, all sorts of issues, Henry, as there are in every jurisdiction around the health service, and issues around that. And I think the other thing about this election, Henry, that's quite interesting is that I think Fine Gael, as the outgoing government party, made a huge miscalculation. I think they felt that they would get rewarded for their handling of Brexit, having seen to sort of defend the Irish interests, Yeah, absolutely, and sort of, you know, being seen to sort of deal with that issue in terms of particularly dealings with the UK government, especially successfully. However, in polls, Henry, that came out around the election, Brexit was only an issue for about 1% of the electorate. Mm. And it was really about an issue about the government trying to prevent certain things happening in the future, as opposed to the here and now, Henry, of an electorate, I think, worn down by years of austerity, worn down by what they see as a dysfunctional housing market, younger people who can't get on the property ladder or can't pay rents in the major cities.
I believe that
problem around homelessness that's been dealt with.
I was about to mention the housing crisis is one of the big issues in Ireland.
I think
Ireland.
It was the number one issue, Henry, yeah.
And of course, pension age, that's another thing.
Yes, never a vote winner, Henry, especially with greyer, older voters who always tend to vote. The pension age has been raised in Ireland from 66 to 67, and suddenly there was articles popping up, Henry, that a lot of people would be caught by this kind of transition, that you might turn 66 and actually have to sign on the dole.
Jesus.
Of course, the government hastily started talking about transition arrangements and things like that. The other thing, Henry, that an almost a decision that seems astonishing, but Fine Gael, just before the election as the government, decided to have a commemoration event. And we're in, Henry, as you know, 100 years anniversary of the War of Independence in Ireland.
Yes.
They decided to have a commemoration event to honour sort of the Royal Irish Constabulary, which would, as you know, Henry, as a student of history, would include the sort of black and tan era.
Oh, yes.
Very
violent time.
Very violent time. And for listeners' benefit, the black and tans were auxiliaries out of the British Army sent over by Winston Churchill in Ireland to bolster or become part of the Royal Irish Constabulary, and were basically guilty of such various atrocities such as burning out villages in response to IRA attacks. This sort of was an almost insane decision, Henry, that was deeply unpopular.
Who made the decision?
Well, this was somebody, Henry, who was hardly seen in the election campaign. The guilty man was identified as the Irish Minister for Justice, Charles Flanagan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quickly put out to pasture during the election campaign, Henry. He was hardly seen at all on television. But he was blamed for what was seen as a politically disastrous decision to even suggest this idea in the first place. So, but it combined, Henry, with other things of a government just completely out of touch with the Irish mood and the mood of the Irish electorate.
I want to talk about Leo Varadkar. He is the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach. He came in as a very... He could do no wrong. You know, he was young, he was progressive, he's gay, and he comes from a family that is, you know, half is not from Ireland. I mean, this is like a futuristic kind of prime minister. What went wrong?
I think a lot of things, Henry. I think number one, just the very nature of sort of Leo Varadkar's personality. He comes across as a bit robotic, but doesn't really sort of feel people's pain or have sort of terrible, great deal of empathy for, you know, issues like homelessness. And but while the government had a homelessness strategy, Henry, it clearly wasn't as effective as it should have been.
Yeah.
And all sorts of accusations that sort of they were, Fine Gael was sort of hamstrung by their sort of market ideology and opposed to greater state intervention. So I think that a kind of lack of empathy. The other thing, Henry, I know it's almost at times kind of a trivial type person. You know, he was preparing for one of the TV leader debates on Irish television, and he tweeted out, I think it was sort of green M&Ms that were in a tray in the green room while he was waiting to go on stage, and people were thinking, well, was that really what you were thinking about before, you know, debating great issues of national importance, and you know, tweeting images of his socks.
Really?
he just seemed a combination of, I mean, it's not a stupid man or anything like that, but just a combination of a kind of lack of emotional intelligence or empathy for how people were really seeing, were feeling, mishandling issues. I must say, a disastrous political miscalculation that Brexit was going to be the key issue in the selection. It clearly wasn't. It was dominated completely by domestic issues like health, housing, the cost of living.
Now, Declan Hughes is a sports presenter at 103.2 Dublin City FM. Declan's been too long since we talked.
Indeed, it has. Way too long. We due to a couple of Sundays off, you see. This is what happened.
Yes, it's true. Now, this week, we're going to talk about all things 80s, because you're the same age as me, I believe. You were born in 1962?
All the best people were, Henry.
Yes, indeed. I have to agree with that. The 80s for us was a time when we were in our early 20s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when you're in your 20s, you really kind of, I always felt like I was a bit of a lost soul, because in your 20s, it's when you want to forge your life. You want to decide who you're going to be, where you're going to go. Now, tell me, did you feel like, let's say, did you feel confident in the 1980s in your 20s?
No, not very at all. It has to be said. Now, just to give you a bit of background, I was in university for the first 3 years or thereabouts of the 1980s. My mum had died when I was 17 in 1979. So I would have been feeling a bit of a lost soul anyway in light of that.
Yes.
I was only 4 weeks in university. I was one of 10,000 people. And thankfully, I met some people early on who were very, very supportive and became a good group of friends. And I'm in regular contact with many of them to this very day. And if I ran into some of the others I'm not in contact with, I've no doubt that there'd be a good rapport, etc. That it's just I've lost their number or whatever. It's been different things, and perhaps the same thing can be said for them. I found the university one of two things that I belonged to outside of my immediate family that I really felt I belonged to. Perversely enough, despite being one of 10,000, because of connections I made in university, particularly to the football club there and other sports clubs over the years subsequently, I felt I belonged to the university in a way that I feel I still belong to it. And in light of the fact that I'm now living on my own, my father has passed on, I've no siblings. That has in effect become my family. And in fact, the young and up-and-coming players in the sports clubs that I am still associated with through my broadcasting and stuff like that, they have become an ersatz family for me. And I don't know where I'd be without the university. I probably wouldn't be in Ireland.
It's very interesting that you say that, because, of course, I fled Ireland like thousands of people back in the 1980s. Actually, strangely enough, I didn't go because I didn't have a job. I left a radio job. I just wanted to get away. I went to the UK and subsequently, obviously, Australia. In the early 80s, what did you want to do with your life professionally?
Well, I went to UCD and I did a degree, not with a view to getting a job, just with giving a view to, I got into UCD, I got into an arts program. I picked two subjects I figured I could stand reading about for 4 years. And true to this day, I can still stand reading about them. So I chose wisely, namely history and political science. As it turns out, they were helpful in me ending up with a degree in public service. A job in public service, not by choice. There was nothing else available. I did try to get into radio, and I did a broadcasting course run by the radio stations you spent many happy years working for. And I was due to start working on a small-scale local pirate in Blanchardstown in 1983, the week after I graduated university. I don't know if I shared the story with you before, Henry. But anyway, I was due to do a program as a disc jockey, don't you know, on Blanchardstown Community Radio on, I think it was the third Monday in October.
Yeah.
So I went out in my on the bus. Blanchardstown was in the middle of nowhere for our listeners who might know Dublin. It was a small, sleepy country village at the time. It's since become a very urbanized suburb. So you had to take a bus, and it would take like forever to get from the city centre. So I left home, to head for my new work, as I thought, at about 7:30 in the morning to be out there in time. Got into the city centre, got on the 39, I think it was. And I arrived about 45 minutes before I was due to go on the air. I arrived in the station to be met by the station attendant, who told me they'd been raided the night before and the transmitter was gone.
And that's a common story from the 1980s.
And my broadcasting career was over more or less before it had begun for a while. My next radio opportunity came up, ironically, the following year on The Official Broadcaster. One of my friends from the university had been asked to appear on a radio show called Record Cabinet, which was like a jukebox jury type thing hosted by Jimmy Greeley.
And this was on RTE Radio 2?
2FM, yeah. And he couldn't do it. But he found that he couldn't do it about 10 days in advance. And I was hanging around in the university at the time. I spent 2 years unemployed, Henry. And that's why most of your generation escaped Ireland, because there were no opportunities of any kind.
Yeah.
You were lucky in that you had gotten into broadcasting, had been reasonably decent at it, and was able to earn a living at it for a while.
We're all just locked down. Is it ever going to end?
Look, you may all be in lockdown, but come on now.
You haven't
done 236 days in lockdown here in Melbourne.
I don't know. I did a fair chunk of it last year.
Well, you did. That's true.
officially
the most lockdown city in the world. Woohoo, number one.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is official, isn't it? And do you know who's behind us there?
Who cares? There's no second.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. First is first, and it's not like a Buzz Aldrin situation.
What does Dry July mean?
It's a thing that's going around, I believe. I've never actually done it, but I don't want to shock you all with that, but I shouldn't just drop those bombs like that without giving a pre-warning, I know. But
I thought it was just when the weather was dry.
No, you make a pledge for charity.
Yeah, and
I know.
You raise money.
I know.
People collect. People pay you not to drink, and then you can take that money to buy a day that you can drink, and so it's also really a waste of time. Isn't that how it works?
I don't know, but
people pay you not to drink, and then you pay the organisation so you can drink. So
I've got a new one that I've come up with that I'm going to try and do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Swearless September.
Oh, Melissa, surely not.
I think people would pay money to see how long I can go without swearing. I don't think I could last 15 minutes, but we could try.
Well, you've been on this show for 2 hours. One shot, and I don't think you swore at all. So you can do it, baby. Call them demonstrations or whatever, protests, but really they were just riots, Adam.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're disgusting. The people who did it should be taken out the back and shot.
Adam, my Facebook friends went. People I know went.
Oh.
And you should see the rhetoric online.
It's very sad news about Shane Warne, one of the world's most iconic cricketers, I would say, passed away last weekend in Koh Samui in Thailand. I know that you would probably know a bit about Shane.
Well, you know, as somebody who, you know, grew up in England, as you know, Henry, I mean, I would have a fairly decent knowledge of cricket. Because, of course, it's a sport that's played quite a lot in England, not as much as obviously in Australia, where it is very much a religion in certain parts of Australia. And, I mean, the news about Shane Warne was shocking. It's not often that I'm stunned when I hear news, but I was absolutely stunned when I heard the news about Shane, because he was only 52 years old,
Henry.
I know.
It's just unbelievable.
And he was... Wisden did a thing at the end of the 20th century. Wisden is like the Bible of cricket. It's basically a book that comes out every year where they have all the statistics and that, but they are like the Bible of cricket. And they named five cricketers who were the cricketers of the century. And it was the great, it was Don Bradman, the great Australian batsman, the greatest batsman of all time. Sir Garfield Sobers, one of the greatest West Indian batsmen. Viv Richards and Shane was in that five greatest cricketers of the 20th century. So he was very highly rated technically, but he was best known because when he threw when he bowled his first ball against England in the Ashes, he bowled what became known as the ball of the century, which was a ball which flummoxed Mike Gatting, one of the senior England players. And even to this day, Gatting still scratches his head as to how the ball swings around him to hit the wicket. And Shane basically revived the art of spin bowling, which was a very much a lost art because, of course, in the days when Shane was coming through, it was all fast bowlers because that was the trend, if you like, whereas Shane brought back the old methods to bowling. And, of course, the fact that he was the bogan's bogan as well, you know, he was the guy that the crowd loved him. It didn't matter whether you were Australian or English, or West Indian, or New Zealand.
Or Indian, yes.
You loved Shane because he was a great competitor, but he was also one of those guys. I was reading an article yesterday that really summed it up, where the guy said that hearing about Warren, it was like losing a friend because you knew him so well, because he'd always been there. And of course, he moved into commentary then when he finished, and a bit of coaching. And he was actually considering throwing his hat into the ring for the job with the England cricket team, which would have been very interesting. But, you know, now we'll never know, Henry, and it's very, very tragic.
This is Bondi Tunes, international broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. A quick hello to some of our listeners around the world. Radio Tatras International, that's RTI in Slovakia. We hope you're feeling well there. And also, I'd like to say hello to Dreamwave Radio, a new station in the UK. I hope you're all well. Now, I've got Peter Herman, who is a correspondent in the capital city of Canberra here in Australia. Welcome to our broadcast.
Good morning, Henry. Actually, good afternoon, Henry, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening, listeners.
Yes.
How are we all today? It's a nice, warm, cloudy day here in the states, or in the country's capital of Canberra, and it's a nice, pleasant 28 degrees. It's cloudy, and it's going to be 31 degrees Celsius. Don't ask me to convert, but it's going to be 31 degrees Celsius tomorrow.
Just to mention, actually, in northern New South Wales, there are many bushfires going on, as you know, Peter. And for our listeners in Europe, this is not good. There are something like 100 bushfires on at the moment. 40 are out of control. And as a result, the smoke is crossing right down to Sydney, where I am. And I went for a jog this afternoon here on Bondi Beach, which, of course, is on the coast. And there's just smoke everywhere. And it's given me a headache, Peter.
Yeah, well, from what I can gather, and I'm looking at a comical TV station, in other words, a commercial TV station at the moment. We call them comicals because they are comical. it's not the national broadcaster, which is the ABC. But anyway, they're saying that they've had bushfires up in the Central Coast. They've had bushfires at Tenterfield. They've got bushfires up in the north coast, and as Henry says, of all the bushfires, there's around about 102 that are burning out of control, and our rural fire service are pushed to the limit. And would you believe they are all started by lightning? They are not ones up in Tenterfield and up in northern New South Wales were all started by fire buggers. But the one in Newcastle was started by lightning, would you believe?
Yes, and it is important to note that people, believe it or not, dear listener, people deliberately light fires in these dreadful conditions. You have to wonder, a lot of them are kids, actually, teenagers. You have to wonder what's going on in their minds.
Well, and I heard somebody say, oh, they've got mental defects. Well, you can't blame mental defects in a child's mind or a child's brain. Unfortunately, you've got to blame, and a lot of times, the parents.
Of course.
Where are the parents when these kids are out there with a cigarette lighter or a box of matches? I know they don't use matches anymore. Where are the parents when these kids are gallivanting around the countryside with a lighter, and they say, "Oh, let's light a fire here. This looks good." Mm. And all of a sudden, whoosh, and it goes out of control, and they head for the hills. And the last fires that were up in Tenterfield were lit by a 13 and 14-year-old kid, and their parents were at the club.
Yeah, unbelievable.
So, you know, why aren't the parents? Well, a lot of the kids today can do what they like, which is, to me, is a terrible way of looking at things.
Mm.
But what can you do about it? You just can't do anything about it. And the poor bloody volunteers that go out there and fight these fires. Some of these guys have been out there for 18, 20, 23, 25 to 30 hours trying to fight the fires.
Yeah.
And these kids are sitting there playing bloody video games.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International. And I talked with Joan Armour Trading, courtesy of Livewire. Welcome, Joan. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very well, thank you. Hope you're good.
I'm feeling good. Thank you. You are a singer, songwriter, producer, and you compose your own songs, Joan.
Yeah, so all the songs that you hear me sing are songs that I've written. I don't do covers, only because I write songs. That's the only reason I don't do covers, is because I think of myself as a songwriter, and since that's what I do, then I want to write songs. And yeah. I really, really enjoy doing it.
I have always followed your music ever since the 70s. I never forget the song like Love and Affection and Drop the Pilot. Do you find that being passionate, that is the basic ingredients of producing a good piece of music?
I think you've got to care about what you're doing, and you've got to have real kind of empathy. And yes, the word passion definitely comes into it.
Yeah.
You've got to really want to do it. I mean, I know in my case, it's not even that I want to do it, it's that I have to do it. I can't imagine not doing it. I think I'd probably be ill if I couldn't write. I just really need to write. That's why there are so many albums, I just keep writing. And it's an absolute joy to be able to write. And what's so nice is that when I've written a song and it gets on the album and people start to hear it, people will say to me, well, I was able to express this emotion to somebody who's using this song because I couldn't quite get it when I was trying to do it, and this says it all. And that, you know, that's not just about my songs. That's about loads of songs out there that people are using to express some kind of feeling to somebody else that they couldn't. And you say you've got words, but music is quite very, very powerful.
It
so
is,
when you
yeah,
put the
yeah.
music to the words, mm-hmm. the whole emotion will come out then.
I understand that you discovered that your love of music started very young. And at first, you looked at your dad's guitar and he didn't allow you to touch it.
That's right.
So you discover you love music ever since you arrived in the UK as a seven-year-old. But you already had a passion to learn music, and you persuaded your mum to buy your first guitar. Is that correct?
Well, I came to England when I was seven. I didn't know at seven that I had a passion for music, but once I discovered it a little bit later, which would, I don't know, but when I was sort of 10, 11, 12, I was writing funny little limericks and funny little short stories and jokes and things like that. And then my mom bought a piano. She just wanted a piano as a piece of furniture to put in the front room. And as soon as the piano arrived, literally as soon as the piano arrived, I started writing songs because, you know, very easy to pick out tunes on a piano. And then my dad used to play the guitar, but he kind of played it in secret and he wouldn't let me touch it. He didn't want me to have anything to do with it. And I think it's just that made me really, really want to play the guitar, because I was just forbidden to have anything to do with it. Then I saw the guitar in the pawn shop. I asked my mother, could I have it? And she said, well, if they'd swap it for two old prams, then I could have the guitar. And that's how I got the guitar. So I taught myself to play the piano and the guitar. But my dad didn't show me anything apart from how to tune the guitar, because tuning the guitar, I think, is the most important thing of when you're learning to play the guitar.
Now, you mentioned music. We will play a song of your choice. You'll present that at the end of our interview. Music, for me, and I'm the same age as you, I loved music in the 70s. By the time the 80s came around, music changed quite dramatically. I was working in a radio station called Radio Nova for half of that decade, and I was constantly exposed to this same top 40 music all day, and I was a newsreader. I wasn't a DJ. And I simply got sick of it. And to me, Declan, the 70s was my time for music, not the 80s. I'm thinking you're going to disagree with me.
I actually straddled 3.5 decades of music. I was in the 60s. I was into music as a small child. I straddled the 70s like you do. I was able to follow the cusp of the... But again, I didn't have to listen to music all day like you did for your job. Although I did have a summer job 1 year, which was one of the reasons why I fell in love with both Nova and Sunshine, the two super pirates, because I got a summer job 1 year when I was a student in UCD in a security company as a security guard. And my shifts were started at 5 in the evening and finished at 8 in the morning. And you'd be on a Monday, a Wednesday and a Friday 1 week, and then you'd be on a Tuesday, Thursday the next. And then you did 2 12-hour shifts on Saturdays and Sundays, and it would be morning or evening depending on what your shift had gone the week before. So obviously if you're working a Friday night, you'd be working a Saturday night if you follow me.
Yeah.
And if you worked a Thursday night, you'd be working a Saturday morning. Do you understand me?
Yes, I get it, yeah.
That was the way the shift worked. So it would be week on, week off with this kind of shift. So, like, my shift consisted of patrolling a premises, turning a key in a lock once an hour, and the rest of the time, you're scratching around for something to do. You do crosswords, but you had to stay awake. So the only way to stay awake was to listen to the music, and the best music was on the Super Pirates.
You've been listening to a mix of contributions from our correspondents all over the world. We'll be back with a second part very soon.